Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum. For more about InForum and its upcoming events, like the Facebook page, or to like the Facebook page, facebook.com/InForumSF, or follow on Twitter at InForumSF. Tonight's hashtag is Angel Guide. You can also watch past Commonwealth Club programs on fora.tv. I'm Michael Copeland, senior editor at Wired, and your moderator for tonight's event, A Guide to Getting Angel Investors. And I'm joined by, on my left here, Dave McClure, an entrepreneur and angel investor, sometimes called a super angel, sometimes called other things, I'm sure, too. He also founded and runs the Incubator 500 Startups. We're also joined by Christina Broadbeck, an angel investor and entrepreneur. She was a founding team member at YouTube and went on to co-found The Icebreak, an app and website that helps couples learn more about each other. We have Naval Ravikant, an entrepreneur and angel investor, and the co-founder and co-maintainer of AngelList, a matchmaking service for startups and funders, and a longtime venture capital hacker. We also joined by Bill Clerico, named one of the best young tech entrepreneurs by Businessweek in 2011. Bill is the co-founder and CEO of WePay, an online payment service provider. And finally, Elad Gil, a serial entrepreneur, investor, and according to his LinkedIn page, a startup helper. Among many other things, he was co-founder of Mixer Labs before it was acquired by Twitter. So thanks to these angels and entrepreneurs for being here tonight and sharing their tips on how to win angel investment. So let's get to it. Let's start with a sort of a definition of what angels are. We've got angels, we've got incubators, we've got accelerators, we've got seed funds, we've got crowdfunding. You know, where does an angel fit into all of this? Naval, let me start with you.
Yeah, so angel investing traditionally used to mean people who were investing their own money and were usually the first investor into a company, as opposed to venture capitalists who would be investing funds. A lot of that definition has gotten fuzzy. The super angels essentially have taken over the angel branding even though they manage funds. And angel investors are often no longer the first investors into a company because often these days incubators are friends and family. So the definition that I like to use is that angels differentiate themselves from VCs and seed funds and others in that they don't buy control as part of their investment, and they usually bundle advice along with their investment. But the definition is quite fuzzy. It's good branding, so a lot of people have co-opted it.
There's a lot of angels out there right now, aren't there? And they're not just doctors and lawyers anymore. They're former entrepreneurs or current entrepreneurs. How has the angel landscape changed in terms of who's participating?
The cost of building a company has come down drastically, especially on the software side. And as that comes down, the set of people who could be considered angels increases. So there was a time when it would take $1 million to make a difference for your startup. Now you could make a difference with $25,000. That allows accelerators to work. That allows angels to work. That allows even small accredited investors to even pool their capital online and go to work. So there a lot of people can be angels now, but that's because companies need less money.
Well, let's talk about needing money. And Bill, let's start with you. How do I know that, you know, I'm at a point, I have an idea, I think it might be a company. When do I go out and raise money?
Yeah, I think we're at an interesting point where, like Naval said, the cost of starting a company is plummeting. Access to capital is increasing. So you have all these accelerator programs that are funding early stage ideas. And so it's sort of tough to figure out what that right point is where it's time to go raise money. I know for us, I can speak from personal experience, you know, we started raising money when we were just two guys and a PowerPoint, and actually didn't have that much success early on. I think there's sort of certain milestones that investors like to see.
So what were angels and those people who were telling you no, what were they telling you and why were they telling you no?
Yeah, typically the way that VCs say no is that they say, we're really excited about what you're doing, but you're just a little bit too early. And so that's typically a no in the investing world. And I think for us that actually was true. Like we were working in a big market, tackling an interesting idea, but we really were just too early. We didn't have sort of the resume of some of the other people up on this panel that could go out and talk to an investor and sort of command investment based on just their background. We were just two 23-year-olds with an idea. So the way we compensated for that was to just start working and start kind of scrapping along. We prototyped an idea. We built a sort of cheap early mock-up, used that to get some early initial users, used that to get funding from an accelerator, used that to sort of build more product and more traction, and sort of managed to kind of build up from there.
Christina, what's your experience along these lines?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's never a right time. I think you're always raising money and you're never raising money in the sense that you never really know what conversation you have with somebody can potentially lead to an angel investment or investment down the road, or if they know somebody and they can introduce you to somebody. But at the same time, a lot of investing is about momentum, and you really want to build momentum for your startup and your company. So you want to make sure that you don't get too many no's, because that might signal to other people who might be interested in investing that they might not want to end up investing also.
So, Dave, if somebody walks in the door and they have an idea, do they need just an idea? Do they need a PowerPoint? Do they need a business plan? I mean, what sort of – there's no one answer, but what do they need to really start the conversation?
Well, if they're talking to someone who might be an angel investor, any of those things might be or might not be necessary, but I think – probably the thing that's most important is some shared passion for the problem to be solved or the business. I think angel investing is mostly about individuals making decisions based on passion, not on economics. That's different if they came to me or came to someone who's professionally managing money, where there's probably a little bit more nuts and bolts analysis of the business. We'd probably be looking less for an idea, more for a product or prototype, hopefully some customers and revenue, and sort of a potential exit down the road. But I think a lot of angel investing, particularly a lot of angel investing these days, is maybe not as informed as it could be or should be, but that's both an opportunity and a risk.
So Dave has become a lot more polished, because I've definitely seen him do passion-driven investing before.
What? Right. Me?
Yeah.
Never.
You know, the bar in the market keeps moving higher. Every 3 months, it gets a little harder to raise money, because everybody else, it's become a little cheaper for them to build their business, so they've gotten a little bit further than that amount of capital, and so the bar has just gotten higher, and the same set of tricks that you might have been using 6 months ago are old hat as of 3 months ago. So this market moves very, very quickly. That's why Dave's having a tough time answering this question, and he's trying to act like he's all analytical about it. But the truth is, if a brand new business walks in, like we were just talking about Bitcoin back in the green room, if some brand new business walks in, they go, Bitcoin, and it's working, it's hot. You know, you get inspired. At the end of the day, a lot of it is very emotional. There's so little information in the market, and you're looking for things that by definition are brand new, that it's hard not to get caught up in the passion.
Right. Well, and also, Elad, let's turn to you. For 10,000, I mean, sometimes these angel rounds are, you know, it's money, but it doesn't have to be a lot of money. So for $10,000 or $20,000 or even $50,000, you can maybe afford to, you know, invest based on your passion.
Yeah, I think like one of the shifts that's been happening in the angel investment market is that you do see a lot of people who are, their day job is running their own company, they're entrepreneurs, and they've started to make small investments in friends of theirs. And so, a few years ago, the minimum angel investment that somebody would have to make to get into a round was probably around 25K, but in some cases, people wouldn't even talk to you unless you were investing 100K or more. And I remember actually when we were raising money for my startup the first time around, we literally would screen people out and just say, we only want to take big checks. And I think that's really shifted in part because, to Naval's point earlier, often angels actually come not just with capital, but also with advice wrapped around that. And a lot of entrepreneurs today really appreciate getting money and advice from people who are more or less in the same boat as them, but a few years ahead. And so you do see this emergence of people investing $5,000 or $10,000 today when before they wouldn't have been able to make it just because of the bar that had been set in terms of how much capital you have to deploy.
So let's start there. Let's say I, as an entrepreneur, know that I want to raise some money, and we hear in Silicon Valley, it's a bit of an odd, I think, circumstance, but everybody and their mother seems to be an angel investor. So how do you filter out my angel from the rest of these angels? And if you get 15, 20 people piling into your company at the beginning, isn't that going to make it sort of hard to manage?
It can. It depends.
Naval,
it depends on what rights and privileges and expectations you set with them. So, for example, when you're first starting out, it's just an idea, probably only your mom's going to fund you. So, obviously, you don't want to lose her money and her love at the same time, so be careful and don't take too much. But, you take a little bit of money. As you get more and more investors in and you have less and less need purely of capital and you have a little bit more patience, then you can be more picky about who your investors are. On AngelList, one of the things we do is we segment what we call the sophisticated investors from the mere accredited investors. And for the sophisticated, they meet the companies, they write larger checks. For the accredited, we create online vehicles where they can put in small amounts of money and follow the sophisticated.
Let's back up for a second.
I think he's describing now a too overly analytical process. I think the entrepreneurs are just as emotional, sometimes way more sure. so than their investors. And often they are not choosers, they are beggars, they are desperate, and they don't always get to choose the terms of the money that they take. That's changing a little bit more in their favor, particularly here in Silicon Valley with platforms like AngelList, but that's far the exception than the rule that the founder is driving the equation.
I want to get to AngelList and kind of its reason for being, but Christina, let's have you jump in here.
Yeah, I think when you get to the point where you can decide what type of investors and advisors also that you want on board, that there's two kinds that you should seek out. The first one being investors and advisors who fill the holes in your team, so have the skill set that you don't necessarily have. So say your team is, all engineers, and you need somebody, you don't know anything about marketing and branding, right? So you should find somebody who's an investor or an advisor who has that skill set. And the second is, fill your investors and advisory board with people who work at companies that you would want to eventually partner with or potentially even get acquired by, because a lot of acquisitions happen based off of relationships.
Well, so let's get very practical. If I would dream of having you as an advisor, Christina, I mean, how do I go about asking and what do I offer in return?
Honestly, a lot of the investments that I've made or even, the people that I advise have come to me through entrepreneurs that I've already invested in. So that's a good way, make friends with somebody that I've invested in. But even just sending me an email a lot of the times works. Like, hey, let's go grab a coffee and I will sit down with you.
Okay. Elad, how do I filter out the dark angels from the good ones?
Yeah. So I guess I'd say three things on that. First, you should reference check. So ask other entrepreneurs that you know or friends of yours who are a little bit ahead of you from a company formation perspective in terms of who they think are the best people who've supported them as an angel. The second thing is that not all angels are going to be equally valuable for all companies. And so really what you should be thinking of your investor set as is an extension of your team. And obviously they're not really on your team and you're doing all the work and they occasionally sort of show up and help. but you should think through the skill set. There are some people who are great connectors, some people are great company builders, people who are great at lifecycle events like selling your company or raising more money or whatever it might be. And so I'd really think of it as that portfolio. And frankly, the needs of your company is going to shift depending on the stage. So the way you can help a later stage company is very different from an early stage company, and it also differs a lot. And by later stage, I mean, you have 50 people versus 10 people or 5 people, as well as by the context of the entrepreneurs. Like, how experienced are they? Have they managed people before? Have they hired and fired? Are those basic skills that they have to learn, in which case the set of angels that they need shifts pretty dramatically?
Bill, you mentioned an incubator, and you were in Y Combinator, correct? Mm-hmm. How do these things kind of exist together in an ecosystem? It sounds to me like you were sort of looking for money while you were, at Y Combinator and building your company.
Yeah, I think – so the nice thing about accelerators in general and Y Combinator, 500 startups and other accelerators that are out there, is that they sort of bundle a bunch of entrepreneurs together. And so – There's a lot of value that the people that run the accelerator can bring, but there's actually, I thought, more value in just sort of my peer group going through that process with 50 other entrepreneurs and learning about how to hire people, how to fire people, how to raise money, how to build a product, how to deal with Facebook, how to deal with Google, how to sort of the day-to-day operational headaches that startups face. And I thought there's a lot of value in just learning from my peer group there and sort of facing a lot of those challenges together, and that was where I think a lot of the value came. And that sort of prepped you. It was kind of like a 10-week boot camp to just sort of get you ready to go talk to angel investors and VCs. Because I think, when you go and talk to an angel investor, if you're a first-time entrepreneur, you're maybe sitting across the table with someone that's worked in the Valley for 10, 15, 20 years. And if this is your first time running a software company. For me, it was the first time working in a software company. It was really helpful to be able to draw on the experience of that peer group to kind of guide me through that process.
Dave, you talk about, and you've built a sort of mentor network, not just here in Silicon Valley, but around the world. And again, what is this community of entrepreneurs and sort of angels? How does that reinforce itself or each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things we're talking about with angel investors are both the money side and the mentorship side. And if you're fortunate, those come together, but oftentimes they don't come together. And I think figuring out and identifying people who can provide mentorship in areas that are relevant, in our case for technology startups, probably in areas like design, engineering, marketing, maybe business development, product. People have gone through raising money before, maybe have sold a company before, might work at a platform company that could be helpful either as a distribution channel or as a potential acquirer.
Platform company like Google, for example, or Facebook, or
Twitter,
Yahoo.
Or maybe even overseas, you know, companies like maybe Rakuten in Japan, which is a large e-commerce company, or Baidu in China, which is a large search company. But I think the important thing is trying to understand how you can get mentorship, and whether that's a peer group, you know, that's working on the product problems the same time you are, or people that might be 2, 5, 10 years ahead of you in experience. In the Valley, that tends to be really easy. They're all over the place. They're right around you. The platform companies are right around you. Outside the Valley, in other parts of the U.S. and other parts of the world, that's not the case. And a lot of times the money that's available is usually just money, not maybe mentorship, or it's
right.
Mentorship from other parts of the business world. So I think what's great about, you know, programs like Y Combinator or 500 Startups or others, maybe they're incubators, maybe they're not, is just collecting a high-density group of individuals who have expertise in building companies, particularly technology startups, and have domain expertise either in skill sets or in customers or in geographic markets that are useful.
And are you guys, Naval, are you looking for sort of low-density opportunities in the sense that there's not a lot of competition in various industries or even geographies?
Yeah, about half of our volume is actually in Silicon Valley, and that's the core. But that said, I think where we add the greatest value is when we take an out-of-market company and introduce them to an in-market investor or an in-market company and introduce them to an out-of-market investor. So we've had companies located locally who have found investors in Europe. For example, a London-based VC led a Series A on a company that found an angelist recently. And we have a company that was in Austin that found a Brussels-based VC as a lead on angelists. We get those kinds of stories a lot. Those are the ones where we basically make something happen that could not have happened otherwise. Most of the time, it's accelerate the financing.
We found a company out of Croatia that we invested in. Actually, they went to Seed Camp in London first, but we saw them on angelist. Called Farmeron that was helping develop web analytics for dairy farms.
Let's describe AngelList a little bit and why. And you know, Naval, you've been sort of, as you say, hacking the venture capital world for a long time. And why AngelList? What's its reason for being? And it's actually taking off quite a bit.
Well, the number of entrepreneurs and startups out there is a lot greater. The cost is a lot lower. The number of angels is greater too. So you need a place for them to sort of organize, keep their info, and connect with each other. And so AngelList started off as just a mailing list for some angels with some deals, just because I thought it was very inefficient that to keep pounding the pavement, doing coffees just to get the word out, especially for a company that might already have a lead investor looking to syndicate the round, or for a company that has some real traction. So today it's more of like a social network or graph. We do a lot of matching. We also do a lot of talent matching because a lot of these companies don't raise money, so then they want to find jobs to startups. So it's become sort of a hub of activity. It's not the only avenue, of course. I would say most investors still get a lot of their deals offline through trusted networks, but I think it's slowly moving online. And there's a bunch of things we can only do online, such as I mentioned the cross-border connection, online investing for small dollar amounts, recruiting talent in high volume, and as well as researching all the companies in a given space or knowing what an investor you may have co-invested with in the past but touch with what are they up to now. So those kinds of things are far more efficient online. But at the end of the day, some things are just more efficient offline. You still have to meet the entrepreneur in person. You have to size them up. So AngelList ends up being an information and introduction network, and it works best for companies that are out of market or have something tangible to show or have a fair bit of traction or are under-recognized relative to their merits.
Have you guys either invested in or received investment without actually meeting the money on the other end? Any of you? Dave is raising his hand.
I've done that more often than I'd like to talk about. I think you can get a lot of information from meeting the person, but a lot of times a lot of the information is also based on the fundamental business metrics of the company. And, I think we 500 Startups is in the business of sort of doing a lot of investments, and so we're willing to take more risk at small dollar amounts.
And those dollar amounts range from what to what?
Our first investment, our first check is usually between 50 to 100,000, sometimes as small as 10. Later checks we might invest up to maybe 100,000 or 500,000. But earlier on, at least for us, because we're doing such a large number of investments, we can sort of try and make decisions more quickly, evaluate more quickly.
So I have some stats on that. We move about 10 to 15 million a month through offline meetups where a company gets introduced to an investor and then go meet with the investor. But right now we're moving about 2 million a month purely online. And that's in small dollar amounts, a very controlled set of companies. Usually they already have a lead investor. Most of the round is full. They're heavily curated, and small investors can follow on behind the big investors completely online. And the average check size there is in the $3,000 to $5,000 range. It's not in the $50,000 to $100,000 range. But you can think of it as crowdfunding for accredited, and it's coming.
Right. I want to get to crowdfunding. But Elad and Christina, when, from the entrepreneur's perspective, when do I run out of the room and say, like, look, I don't care how much money you have. I don't care, you know, how great your connections are. I don't want anything to do with you.
That's really tough to answer because I think a lot of that is based off of, you know, how do you get along with this person? And I think you really do need to spend like an hour with them or 2 hours or spend a little bit of time to figure out, you know, do our personalities clash or not, right? Because ideally, especially on the angel stage, you're going to be working with this person. They're going to be giving you advice. And you want to make sure that they're enhancing your company and relationship instead of deterring your relationship and your company. Like, you don't want to feel like they're not helping you move forward. And I think a lot of that is just based off of one-on-one interaction, and you'll just kind of get that gut feeling or not.
I would add a few things to that as well. I mean, the first one is that if the investment is a large amount of money for the person and they're not used to making angel investments, you should definitely run away.
Have you done that?
Invested more money than I have or something? No, fundamentally, I think the issue is that if somebody isn't very savvy about investing in private companies and they're not assuming as an individual angel that they're going to lose the money, mm-hmm. then they can actually become a huge pain in the butt because they're really worried about the investment. They're going to call you a lot. They're going to nag you about things. And really, you don't need that from an investor. What you want from an investor is somebody who is helpful and when called upon shows up or sometimes proactively pings you to see if you want help, but isn't going to sort of get in your business and start freaking out about things. And if somebody has a lot of capital exposed and they don't understand that angel investment is really risky and that they're very likely to lose that money, that's one thing that I would definitely avoid no matter what. The second thing is sometimes you can see how people talk about the business and talk about you as an entrepreneur. If they talk down to you, if they say, hey, I'm the gray hair that's going to help you out, but in a way that's very condescending, like those are all very bad signs as well in terms of whether or not you should have that person get involved. So I think there's a few signs or cues that you can pick up on. And this happens, I think, more outside of Silicon Valley than in Silicon Valley, although it sometimes happens within Silicon Valley. And I guess the last one that I just threw in there is if they have really complicated or weird terms. That no
your
matter what happens to the company.
Child plus 40%
exactly.
of your company.
Yeah. That's more like a co-founder agreement, actually. it's more, you know, they ask for a very large return built into the company no matter what. Or they ask for the ability to block certain things like an acquisition or other things, even though they're only buying a very small part of the company. I've seen a few situations where entrepreneurs have shown up in Silicon Valley, they started their company somewhere else, and they took angel money from somebody that they happen to know who's an executive at a tech company in another state, and they show up here and they have a really weird funding situation where they're bound by all sorts of terms that make it very difficult for them to raise follow-on funding or to execute other parts of their business. And so in general, you know, those are three criteria that I think that really help screen people out.
Dave. I think I have a simpler matrix. Not that anything that Elad said isn't absolutely like great advice, but I think there's a very simple 2x2 matrix, which is smart money and not so smart money, and assholes and not assholes. And then there's the two combinations of those. So in an optimal world, you have smart money that's not an asshole. But a less optimal world but still acceptable world is not so smart money that's not an asshole. And sometimes smart money that's an asshole is okay, although I'd be a little bit cautious there. The one that you don't want is the not smart money and an asshole. And so trying to stay away from those probably is helpful.
I think another really useful thing, too, is to like talk to other entrepreneurs that have them as investors, because entrepreneurs do talk, and you kind of and ask them, like, what do you think of this person as an investor? They're interested in investing my round, and for the most part, you'll get honest feedback.
Naval and Dave, actually, all of you, in some sense, have been using angel and VC interchangeably. But is it?
Yeah, and it's sometimes misused.
Yeah, right? I guess if I step back, the definition I think is there's three things: advice, control, money. Traditionally, VCs have bundled all three.
Right.
Angels have provided just advice and money. Incubators provide mostly advice, and now they're sources of pure money. So the smart entrepreneurs know how to purchase which bundle and when. What you don't want, which is what you're hearing from Dave and from Elad and others, is that you don't want a small investor who buys control and gives you money. If you're going to take a small amount of money, there's no point in giving up control provisions of any kind.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit.
Unless you're desperate and don't have access to as much money.
Right.
Hopefully that's happening.
But usually what will happen is if you give up control in exchange for money too early, you will not be able to raise more money later. It will shut you out of the capital market.
And control, I mean, give us sort of a rule of thumb. I can give up X percentage of my company for what kinds of amounts of money?
So normally when angels buy into a company, they should have the right to preserve their economic rights. They're minority shareholders, so you don't want to be in a situation where they can get ripped off by the entrepreneur. But people know what those are. Those are pretty well bounded. What you don't want to give them is control that's inordinate to their holdings. For example, if they have 10% of the equity in the company, they should not be able to veto a transaction that might make them some money, but in their minds, not enough. That would be one example.
So blocking rights against acquisitions is something you probably want to avoid almost in all scenarios.
Right. But then to Elad's point, most of the grief occurs not because they have contractual rights. It's because they just are not happy with the way the company's headed. They're constantly on your back. And you just feel social pressure into constantly care and feeding of your investors rather than in building your company. And small companies require constant changes, constant pivots. And if you have a committee of people you have to keep happy, it becomes very difficult to make a lot of the radical decisions that are required.
But even in an angel round at the very beginning, you can expect to give away 10%, 20% of your company?
Usually no more than 20. It's unusual to give away more than 20.
Right. Are there?
I don't think that's always that standard. I think a lot of angels are not necessarily looking for specific terms on economics. In Silicon Valley, that may be true, but in most other places, that's probably not true. And it could be too much or too little, or they don't even care necessarily about those provisions. They're really, again, what I was saying before, more passionate about solving the problem or the customer and sort of being involved on that angle. But in general, it's like angel investors usually are making individual decisions for themselves and for their money. Professional investors or VCs are representing a pool of capital that's from other people. They have fiduciary responsibilities. They hopefully need to make more informed and rational decisions, although that doesn't always happen.
I don't think anyone's done this math, but my guess is if you were to plot it out, you would find that over time, the percentage of the equity that's in the hands of the talent as compared to in the hands of the capital is changing. The talent is keeping more and more of the equity. As these companies become cheaper to build, more of the surplus is going to the talent.
Yep. Right. So I, as a company creator, get to keep more of what I built. What kinds of companies? I mean, we have sort of assumed, I think, that everything we talk about right now are software companies, for lack of anything better. But are there other angel deals? Are we seeing more hardware deals? Are we seeing, you know, on Kickstarter you see restaurants and my one-act play, which I'm going to ask you guys all to fund after this is over. What kinds of deals are smart to get done via angels? And then when do you start to turn to things like crowdfunding?
We're seeing tons of hardware deals get done by angels.
On Angelist Naval?
Yeah. Software is eating the world. Software is eating hardware. Software is in telecommunications, eating healthcare, it's eating education. Bitcoin, it's eating currency. It's eating government. Software is everywhere. Software is at the core of it. So the software enables communities to stitch things together. You have Uber going after taxis, Airbnb going after hotels. You're seeing every industry is now taking on software-like characteristics. That's not to say you can get a drug through FDA approval purely on software, but you're going to see biotech companies that are cleverly route around either through 3D printing of tissue or testing stuff overseas or through putting disease databases online. You're going to see software attempting to route around every other industry. So they're all taking on software characteristics, even if they aren't all there yet.
Not software, it's a cab ride. Elad, I mean, restaurants.
Try it without the software.
Believe me. Restaurants, I want to build a new kiteboard. I want to open a resort that caters to kiteboarders. What are sort of angel deals and what aren't?
I actually don't have a good definition because I think ultimately it depends on how you define angel, and if you define angel as somebody with capital, to Naval's point, who's also providing advice, then you could argue that somebody investing in a restaurant who has a background in the industry is an angel in that restaurant. I think from a Silicon Valley perspective, usually it's a technology-driven company or a company that has a strong technology component, which allows that company to reach real scale. And by scale, I mean $100 million in revenue or more. Right. That would be like a rough definition.
Yeah, the one problem all investors face is getting an exit. So generally, most angels won't invest in a deal that they don't think a VC will come into later, because otherwise their investment will get stranded when the company runs out of cash. So many of them look for these larger deals. And then traditionally, most investors, VCs or angels, don't invest in cash businesses because it's too hard to audit and it's too easy for the money to go out the back door.
Right.
So that's why restaurants tend not to be as popular.
VCs invest in restaurants, but not as venture capital investments.
They do it to buy expensive tables.
Sometimes they do. They invest a lot of wineries. That's not necessarily a great return investment. But
it's good parties.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Sequoia has a hamburger company right now.
They're grilled cheese company.
Yeah, that's like grilled cheese.
But that's an entrepreneur who made them money in technology before. So.
And it's all about the software, the grilled cheese. I've had it.
They actually 3D print it. So you can pay with a Bitcoin to buy it.
It's delivered by a drone.
I think we make a joke about this, but I think there's been a class of investing, just generally speaking, venture capital has been high risk, high capital intensive sort of businesses. So, low probability of success, but if they...
for
many nerds in Valley, a low probability of sex as well. Often a different story. Oh, man. Yeah. This is on radio, right? I'm sticking my foot in it. Hopefully that's all. But I think venture capital investing traditionally has been a low probability business with a high multiple outcome when it does succeed. The thing that's interesting now is that a lot of people are investing and a lot of businesses are getting started that actually aren't very capital intensive to get off the ground, at least in the beginning, and might have a relatively higher probability of success than a traditional, high-risk venture business. And so you see a lot of companies where maybe they only need, sweat equity or $50,000 to $500,000 to get the product built, get some customers off the ground, and get to a modest level of break-even, which in the business we sort of call ramen profitable, enough to buy you a cup of ramen noodles to survive. And I think that's fueling a different type of investing than used to be around before. The opportunity there is that a lot more small businesses, maybe small being 1 to 10 million in revenue, could be built using that type of capital. The challenge is there's still a hard time getting exits with those type of businesses so that the investors can get their money back. And if the investors don't get their money back, they're going to have a tough time finding the motivation to get in the first place.
Let's turn to crowdfunding. And Bill, did you guys think about it? And Christine, I want you to chime in too. I mean, where does this fit in? Because all of a sudden, crowdfunding has taken off so dramatically that, people's goals are exceeded by huge multiples.
Yeah.
I wanted to raise $100,000 and oops, I raised $10 million instead. It's bizarre and I can't quite understand or think about whether it's healthy or just bizarre. So
yeah, I think it's a fantastic opportunity with some risks along the way. And I think crowdfunding wasn't something that we considered to fund WePay, but being an online payments company, a lot of folks use our API to build crowdfunding sites, actually. And so we have a variety of crowdfunding sites ranging from donation sites, like I want to raise money for a surgery or a sick friend or, you know, because I want to go on this mission trip, sort of really small-scale crowdfunding.
Right.
And then there's, you know, on the other side of the spectrum, there's equity-based crowdfunding where, you know, I'm a company, a tech company that wants to raise money from a collection of small investors, and you know, I want to take $1,000 or $3,000 investments, similar to what Naval was talking about earlier.
Yeah, it's very important to distinguish among the different kinds of crowdfunding. There's project or product-based crowdfunding, like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, where you or CrowdTilt or whatever, where you're not getting anything other than the product in exchange.
You hope.
Yeah, yeah. There's equity crowdfunding by small investors, non-accredited investors, and that's not legal yet. The SEC still has to make the regulations around it. That's
and that would mean for my $3,000, I get a share, I get equity in your
company. Correct. Although if you're an accredited investor, you can engage in the equivalent of crowdfunding light, which is one, the thing that I was talking about earlier, where you can write a check entirely online on the
internet. And an accredited investor is?
Net worth of over $1 million, not counting your primary residence, and or an income of at least $250,000.
Rich people.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Who aren't necessarily any smarter than not rich people. So.
But does crowdfunding start to horn in on the sort of territory and the neighborhood of angels?
I think it definitely does. I mean, we see is there's projects like Pebble or Lockatron that have raised millions and millions of dollars. I think Pebble raised over $10 million.
Pebble is that smartwatch, right?
Yeah, it's a smartwatch. And so here's a company that was in an accelerator, set out, I think, with a goal to raise $100,000 to do a first production run, and then it went massively viral and they raised $10 million.
Right.
On one hand, it's a really great thing. On the other hand, it can be a little bit tough for an entrepreneur who's expecting to ship 500 units and now has to ship 50,000 units. And so I think, like, there's definitely tremendous opportunity there, but there's sort of some risks as well.
And just because, in a lot, and Christina too, just because I can raise the money, so this is the part of it that I find a little bit disconcerting, is that if my goal was $100,000 and I knew and I thought I could pull off what I wanted to pull off with $100,000, and I'm like, well, I can raise $10 million, so why not? Should I?
Yeah, so I personally tend to be very anti-go out there and raise a lot of money. I'm much more about, you know, raise as much money as you need or as much money that will get you through, you know, a year to be able to survive. Because I think businesses really need to exist. Like, what happens if you don't raise a Series A, right? What happens if you don't raise any more money? Like, you really need to think about how are we going to bring in revenue and how are we going to exist if that doesn't happen. And so I would really like to see entrepreneurs focus more on that side of things, like creating real businesses that actually turn a profit.
Yeah, to Christina's point, I think the number of startups is going to go up 10x from here, but the number of funded or fundable startups is not going to go anywhere near that amount, nor should it. You know, as the internet makes us a lot more efficient, it becomes the optimal size of a company shrinking. You need less people to do the same number of things. But that doesn't mean everyone should run out and raise money and think they're going to be a $1 billion company. It means that there should be a lot more startups that are started that never raise any money, that stay as small businesses, but make very good revenue, very good cash, and create good products.
And isn't that a lot? Isn't that okay? Can't I start a company and run a business and actually be profitable without, you know, bringing in investors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just comes down to what the objectives of the entrepreneur are. And people start companies for different reasons and for different objectives. And it's obviously great if somebody starts a business and it grows to a certain scale and they're really happy with the revenue that they're producing and they're employing a great group of people. Like, that's obviously a great outcome. You know, depending on the entrepreneur, you may or may not want that path. You may want to try and build something that, you know, reaches a larger number of people or has other characteristics of a larger scale business. And so it really just comes down to the personal objectives of the entrepreneur.
Well, so let me ask you that. I mean, you guys sold your company to Twitter. Bill, you're on your way. I mean, why did you sell? And, you know, and now what?
Yeah. We sold for a number of reasons, including the fact that we just felt that we had a unique opportunity. So to take a step back, what we built was a developer platform where we allowed people writing software to come on our platform and enable their applications for geolocation. And when Twitter approached us for acquisition, we were really excited by the fact that they had an ecosystem of hundreds of thousands of developers that our product could reach. And so ultimately, it was a way to dramatically extend the impact of what we were building. And we thought the company in general, like, we knew some of the people from before, and we thought it was a great crew to be part of, and they were on a great trajectory. So all those things really seemed to line up very well.
They also backed up a dump truck full of stock. So
money might.
Elon's just smiling. He's like,
money might have had something to do.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know how to respond to something like that.
I was,
it was a very small
very
truck.
Yeah,
it was a very small truck.
All right, the small.
It was more like
it was a cute little dump truck.
One of the little mini Euro trucks.
Yeah, it was actually a Tonka truck.
Bill, you know, you're in the thick of it now. You must sort of weigh the advantages, the opportunity of taking more money versus, sure, you know, giving away more of your company.
Yeah, I think it comes down to, like Elad said, the objectives of the entrepreneur. And that's sort of the first thing I tell when I talk to people that are just starting out. I think you have to have clarity about what you're trying to achieve. Like for us, we've raised $20 million. We're on a different track, and an exit for us that's successful for us and our investors looks a lot different than a company that's only raised $500,000. And so, you know, I talk to entrepreneurs, and there are great, great businesses that are 10, 15, 20 person companies that are profitable, where everyone makes a great living and, you know, all is well. Those are not companies that should raise venture capital because
or even angel funding, or let's be clear.
I mean, possibly not angel funding either.
No,
I think it depends on the angel.
They could raise angel funding and not venture capital, and that would still be okay.
I think there's one very important thing we've left out here, which is that most technology businesses are winner-take-all businesses. Not all, but most. Most of the traditional ones you've heard of. And if you're in a winner-take-all business, you need to put all the wood behind that arrow. So very often, even though you may not want to, you end up raising money. If you're not in a winner-take-all business, if like a restaurant is a good example, and many can coexist, then you absolutely have the option of not taking capital, taking very little capital. But everyone who ends up, you see this all the time. Company goes into a winner-take-all business. They don't raise that much money. They start doing extremely well. They hit profitability, and then they turn around and announce a large VC financing. Why is that? Insurance. They're getting a lot more money, they're getting a lot more advice, they're getting a lot more momentum, and they're just making sure that there's no chance they'll lose this giant lucrative market. So a lot of it has to do with the characteristics of the market itself.
I just want to get to the Q&A. We're going to be getting to your questions in about 3 minutes. So if you have something to ask, you'll want to formulate your question, not your sales pitch, and line up at the mic right about now. So again, think about single one-part questions. And we will get to those in about 2-3 minutes, okay? Christina, you're an entrepreneur. You're also an angel investor. As an entrepreneur, what are your goals then for your company right now?
As an entrepreneur, my goals for my company is, so our company, the parent company above that, you know, the Icebreak is a product underneath it, is to create products that help people to grow in their personal development. And the Icebreak is focused on relationships or one aspect of your personal development. So we're really we're coming out with a new product that is kind of in the space of personal development. So we want to get that out in the next couple months. Our goals for the company are much more focused on not going the acquisition route and just creating recurring revenue and then doing like profit sharing with our investors.
And are your investors of the VC flavor, or did you start in the angel world, or did you guys bootstrap?
Both my co-founder and I, because we got really lucky working at YouTube, we're the largest investors in our company, but we do have some investors, like Dave is actually one of our investors, but we did raise a very small round.
Right. But you're not looking to raise much more money.
Not looking to raise any more money.
And is that because of control, or is that just because, look, this is a sort of perfect size, perfect kind of way of building a company for you right now?
I think it's a combination of personal decision between all of the co-founders involved. And then also, you know, I don't want to just go out there and get our one app acquired, right? Because I feel like what we can do can be so much bigger in terms of the broader vision than just the Icebreak as one app.
Okay. You guys are lining up nicely.
Wow.
Well done. Naval, again, I want to know AngelList. I mean, you're an entrepreneur in this as well. What was wrong with the way angel investing was done before? I mean, and I kind of worry that, you know, what you and Dave and others are doing is professionalizing kind of angel investing when it used to be, you know, dentists and doctors and lawyers, and it was kind of quaint.
But I'm not sure it was ever
quaint.
So Silicon Valley angel investing was never really that quaint. I think you may be referring to outside geographies. Look, it's the internet. The internet has taken everything over, and information is becoming more free and more liquid. Everything's becoming more transparent. It's moving faster. It's democratizing. And if we didn't do it, somebody else would have. You can't stand in the way of the tide of history.
All right. Well, let's,
Alad. I was just going to say really quick to Naval's point about the history of capital in Silicon Valley. There's a really great documentary I'd recommend watching called Something Ventured, and it talks about the very early stages of Silicon Valley and how groups of angels used to meet up at a hotel here in San Francisco and discuss and trade deals back in the 60s.
And I think a lot it was Bin 38, right?
No. Yeah, that came later.
Inside joke.
Yeah. But a lot of those people then actually went on to found a lot of the venture capital firms in the area. And I think it's kind of interesting to think about a parallel transition that's happened more recently where a lot of people who started off as individual angels ended up raising their own funds. You know, Mike Maples, I think Dave started that way as well.
Yep.
So,
absolutely.
You know, Michael Deering. So a lot of the people who are like the really prominent angel names today started in a way that is analogous to what happened 40, 50 years ago.
And so right.
It's an interesting cycle.
And they come from an operational background, which is to say that they've built their own companies, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think PayPal is probably the Fairchild of our day, at least, you know, from my experience. A lot of what I learned about angel investing was watching other people like Peter Thiel and Reid Hoffman do angel investing, who I, you know, followed because I worked with them at PayPal, and then as they went on to other things. I think the Trader Estate and the folks left Shockley and started Fairchild, and then eventually started a bunch of other semiconductor firms and some of the venture capital firms. That history is maybe somewhat forgotten by a lot of folks today, but it's continually mirrored by new sets of people coming out of Microsoft, Intel, Yahoo, eBay, Facebook, Google, you know, now Twitter, maybe other companies in the future, YouTube.
Let's go to questions. Let's start right here. One question per person, please.
Hi, my name is Matt Tindall, company's Tinge. We're building a better rating system. And my question is, there's so many sources for seed and early stage funding, VCs, seed funds, angels, crowdfunding. Do these play nicely with each other, or are you better off just focusing on one or two?
Sometimes they play nicely. Sometimes
I think it's highly contextual. For the most part, you should try every source. It really depends the stage your company's at. Most of these are stage-based, so Kickstarter and crowdfunding make more sense for early stage or for project or for certain kinds of hardware companies. If you don't have a product yet, it probably makes sense to go to an accelerator, especially on the software side. If you do have a product or a prototype, maybe some evidence of customer demand, you can go to Angels, AngelList, whatever, seed funds. And then if you've got a lot of traction, you go to a VC. Those are the rules of thumb, but there's a lot of variance in the middle.
Thank you. Question over here.
Hi, my name is Prasanna Krishnan. Thank you for the program. I have a question for Naval and anybody else that wants to comment. In an example of a business that is not software or tech related, but let's say it's renewable energy, and it's a worker and community-owned co-op, what would somebody that has such a business need to know about angel investing, such as returns, control, et cetera? Thank you.
Yeah, that's really out of my purview. I deal mostly with tech companies, and unfortunately that is so contextual. If you drop me an email, I'm happy to take a shot at it, but it's a tough one. You can guess my email address. It's pretty obvious.
I mean, I think one class of investing that probably isn't always discussed here is social impact investing, and there are some parallels between for-profit startup investing and social impact, and sometimes they are even the same thing. But I think, you know, figuring out how you get returns on that investment and whether the investors want returns on it probably has a lot of impact as to whether you can do certain types of, you know, social impact investing that might be helpful to a lot of people but may or may not have an exit opportunity.
Another question on this side.
Hi, my name is Kartik Ram. I'm a Valley executive now in Singapore building e-marketplaces and watching the growth there. I hear about Series A crunch and other elephants in the room here. And I haven't heard it addressed, so I'd love to know, is there one, and is it because of a supply imbalance, or is it all just an illusion?
So the question is about the Series A crunch, and what that means is the gap between these smaller angel and seed rounds and the sort of first professional venture capital round, which could range from 3 to 5 to 7 million versus 10,000 to 500K. So is there a Series A crunch, or is that a bunch of hoo-ha from VCs who would like us to believe that?
Dave has a very strong opinion on this one, so go for it, Dave.
Well, I've been quoted as saying there's absolutely no fucking Series A crunch, but getting past that, I would say there's
that's a lot of hoo-ha, I guess.
Can I introduce part B of this boxing match, by the way?
Yeah.
Because the guy who coined the term the Series A crunch is sitting right at the end over there, Elad Gil.
That famous tweet of yours is actually in response to a tweet of mine, I think.
Yeah, he created a concept, he wrote a post about it, then TechCrunch picked it up and off it went.
You've got the two opposite ends of Series A crunch.
Okay, so Dave, right, why is there no Series A crunch? And then we get to a lot, and he can counter your argument.
I would say there's a lot of companies being created right now that are not going to get Series A funding, a lot more than ever before, and the number of VCs doing a Series A funding isn't keeping up with that pace. So in that sense, there is a crunch of sorts. The issue I take with it is people tend to equate that with the dot-com blow-ups of 2000, 2001, or the more recent one in 2007 and 8, and I think that's not what's going on. In fact, the overall ecosystem of angel investing, whether it's on AngelList, with seed funds, with incubators, whatever, is a lot more intelligent, informed, efficient than it ever was, certainly way more than 5 or 10 years ago when we were throwing a lot of money into companies that really were just concepts, $5 million into a lot of companies to get them to market. And so there's an incredible amount of wasteful capital that VCs were putting into the market. And now I think you've started to see, because of the reduced cost of product development, because of the increased access to customers, we're maybe only spending $50,000 to $500,000 finding out whether people are idiots or whether their businesses are bad ideas. We're not spending $5 million figuring out whether those are bad ideas. And there are many other sources of capital than just venture investors. So, again, crowdfunding, incubators, seed funds, they may not need millions of dollars to get to a sustainable level of business or a reasonable sort of outcome. So in that sense, I think the term is overplayed a lot, and it focuses too narrowly on the type of investing that happens in Silicon Valley at the institutional level. In that world, yeah, there's a lot more things coming at VCs. Not necessarily a bad thing that all of those don't get funded, and probably really great for those VCs because the caliber of company and the quality that they see has dramatically risen in the last few years.
Elad.
I think Dave articulated it really well. I mean, the perspective I take is very much a Silicon Valley-centric one, and I think in the context of Silicon Valley, the number of angel-seeded startups has gone up dramatically. The number of Series A's that are happening have not. And so that means that the set of people who can successfully raise a Series A has, relative to that proportion, has declined dramatically and has been exacerbated by the fact that many of these seed startups then go out and raise a bridge round, which gives them another 6 months of life or 12 months of life.
And a bridge round could be debt, it could be...
It's usually a convertible debt round,
right.
And so they're raising money that hopefully will convert into equity. And they run into a situation where they're then competing with all the other startups that have been founded in the last 18 months. Frankly, this isn't a very new phenomenon, in my opinion. I think a year ago, the exact same dynamic was going on.
Right.
It's just getting reported on a lot more right now.
I mean, boo-hoo is all I can say about the Series A crunch. It seems like a non-issue to me, honestly. For what that's worth.
I think the hidden story inside the Series A crunch, and it's a great meme, so thanks for coining it and fighting it and all that kind of entertaining, but I think the hidden story is that venture capital does not do Series A's anymore. They've all retreated to Series B's. What traditionally used to be Series B's is growth rounds. That's what most VCs are doing. The seed funds have stepped up and are doing the old school Series A.
Right.
And I think that's going to lead to a fundamental shift of power. Sand Hill Road became so powerful because they were the first credible check into your company. Now the first credible check is Mike Maples or Dave McClure or Paul Graham, Y Combinator or Elad. And so the relationships the entrepreneurs are building are with a different cast of characters.
Right.
And hopefully that happens not just outside Sand Hill Road, but outside Silicon Valley and even outside the U.S.
Question over here.
So Dave mentioned social impact investing is not really discussed here as much, but for hybrid venture, this nonprofit spinning off a for-profit, do you have any advice for finding angel investors for like the social impact investor space?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a lot of sources for social impact investing that are for-profit that you could find through normal angel sources and on AngelList and others. There's a conference that's held here in San Francisco called SOCAP, Social Capital Conference, put on, I think, hosted by Kevin and some of the folks at Good Capital. That's a great resource, and that website is also available for people to look at as well. There's starting to be very specifically designed social capital funds, some of which are for-profit, some of which are less focused on profit but more focused on the type of investing. And there's also foundations and other institutions that do grant-based investments. Those have been around for a while and are, very well-known folks like the Gates Foundation and others that do great work. But I think what's interesting is a lot of those are starting to morph into opportunities to do social good and make a sustainable capital return, and that's where I think it becomes a lot more exciting and hopefully a lot more scalable.
You, sir.
Ron Young, doing my fourth startup since 96. Previous three had successful exits. Question is about convertible debt. What do you like about it? When do you not like it? And what about size and what about caps? for convertible debt.
So let's define what convertible debt is first. Who wants to, Elad, you seem like you're ready to tell us what convertible debt is.
Pull
it out of your back pocket right now.
Okay. Convertible debt is basically money that's raised as debt versus as somebody buying shares directly in your company, but that debt has a term under which it will convert into equity at some point. So it'll convert into actual shares of the company. And that can be triggered by a number of events. It could be triggered by a time period. It could be triggered by you raising a round where you're selling shares. And so then the debt converts into the same type of shares as you sell in that round. Or sometimes it can convert under a change of control or acquisition as well.
So you can either pay me back or I have the option to own a chunk of your company.
Yeah, and most people who are investing in convertible debt invest because they're using it as a mechanism to convert into equity eventually. So usually they're not interested in the interest rate, which is set actually quite low relative to the risk of the company. It's much more a way to fund the company without having to buy shares up front, and it's a much more entrepreneur-friendly approach.
So,
a way to do it without synchronizing the price among the investor participants.
So, okay, so as an entrepreneur, any of you chime in, like, why do I like it or not like it?
There's just no paperwork compared to raising equity around. So usually... To go raise equity, you got to go hire a law firm. You have to negotiate all these covenants. There's all these investor rights. There's, you know, reps and warranties. Whereas usually, like, a convertible debt note will be 1, 2, maybe 3 pages. You know, a law firm can do it for a few thousand dollars versus $30,000.
Although Deval's now doing that also online via AngelList.
Yeah, but honestly, this topic bores me to tears.
This is an interesting question, though. Like, you know, right. I am passionate, optimistic entrepreneur. I step into a room with you, rapacious, venal lot who have money. Do I need to arm myself with lawyers and accountants and, bodyguards? Or
actually, it's not the lawyer and the accountants. It's the advisors. That's why if you have someone like Elad advising you, if you've gone to YC or 500 startups, or if you're Christina, you've been around the block and done this before, it's a pretty quick answer.
Right.
But it's so highly contextual because there are tax differences, pricing differences, paperwork differences, closing times, how the IRS treats them, and all that stuff that I don't want to sit here on stage and give you a giant legal checklist.
Right. Okay, question over here.
Hi there. I'm trying to find out anecdotally if you guys can talk about the one that got away. There's a story around a startup that got away from
million
you guys.
Stories.
Well, so many.
One of them sitting in the audience, I think, Living Social. I probably should have figured out how to invest in that. Aaron sort of has done very well for himself and for the company. I didn't invest in Uber. I didn't invest in Airbnb. I didn't invest in Fab.com. Jesus Christ, the number of companies that I saw or had the entrepreneur ask me to invest that I said, no, I'm a stupid fucking idiot, like a multiple million times
over. Every honest investor has a larger anti-portfolio than they have a portfolio. But it's the kind of game where you only need to win once or twice.
Elad, have you let some get away?
I'm sure there are. I do very fewer investments than I think a lot of the other folks up here. So, but yeah, I'm sure there's tons of stuff that I missed out on.
And do you get calls and Christina too from the people who wanted to and who said no and now like wait, take me back, please?
Yeah, I think it's funny when you're making an investment as an angel investor. You're trying to extrapolate a return in 5 years from a one-hour meeting. And so there's a lot of uncertainty that goes into that. And so the sort of term in the valley is social proof. So people look around to see who else is investing. Right. So a lot of times you get this dynamic where you're pitching and pitching and pitching and nothing's really getting through. And then one person says yes, and then the whole thing just sort of flips.
Right.
And so I've definitely had people that have said no to me before or said, really excited, but you're too early. And then all of a sudden, 3 weeks later, I'm not too early.
what did you tell those people?
I think, that's just sort of the nature of the game. I think,
I'm really excited, but you're too late.
Yeah, sometimes you just don't have room in the round for people. But I think you try to make room for the ones that can help.
Right.
I think the phenomenon at play is mostly rational. The reason being that in the public market, when Warren Buffett buys a stock, you can see that and you can follow him, but the price of the stock has moved to adjust for his buying it. That doesn't happen as quickly or as much or at all sometimes in the private market. Also here, everyone is privy to different little pieces of information. Dave might have worked in a similar product before, so he might know something about it. Christina might have worked with a coworker before and know about it. Bill might have been tracking the company for 6 months. So if one of them makes a move, they're bringing new pieces of information to the table. So you're watching new information come in and the price isn't moving, so you, to be rational, you would change your mind. So that's kind of why social proof works. It's actually not the same phenomenon as like you're standing in the street and 10 people look up, right? And therefore you look up. It's not quite monkey see, monkey do. There
it's
are
not
aspects
that quick
of
and
it.
Efficient.
But if the market had full-on pricing and full information for everyone, then you wouldn't have it to the same extent.
But you do have a lot of copied behavior, I think, that everyone seems to agree, you know, 3 months ago, a year ago, wasn't rational, and now all of a sudden is extremely rational, and yet, you know, a year later might look really stupid again. And I think that happens quite often.
And I also feel personally that the best deals that I've done have been the deals where I didn't know anybody else who was investing and I kind of just went off my own gut. The deals where I've known who else was in the round and I kind of paid attention to them have been the worst deals I've done. So I've learned...
Names? No.
So I've definitely learned to trust my gut more and not care about who's in the deal.
It's time for our last question. And it is the informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following. So Dave, Christina, Naval, Bill, and Alad, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
Well, actually,
Dave, let's start with you.
I kind of feel like I'm working on some of those already. I think one of the things we're trying to do is bring a lot of the kind of practices of Silicon Valley to other places around the world. So we've done probably close to 500 investments so far in the last 3 years. Probably about 130 to 150 of those have been outside the U.S., so we really see a lot of opportunity in Latin America, in South and Southeast Asia, in East Asia, and in Eastern Europe and Arabic-speaking markets, and trying to figure out how we can, you know, make money but also bring capital to talented entrepreneurs in those markets, and actually thinking we're starting to make a dent there.
Great. Christina.
So the one thing that I kind of mentioned before that I'm working on is, you know, I would really like to see how do we use technology to help in the health and wellness and personal development space. So I feel like I'm working that on the entrepreneur side. But also on the investing side, I'd really like to get more involved with how do we increase access to capital for female entrepreneurs, because I definitely think that that's a big issue.
Naval.
I'm big into democratization and empowerment. I think the future is everyone working for themselves. AngelList is just one step out of hundreds in that direction. And I think long term, you know, the size of the firm is going to shrink to one. Information technology will reverse the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
Bill.
I like to pick large, stodgy, regulated industries. In this case, we're in electronic payments. And bring software to bear to make them more accessible. And so I think there's huge opportunities in transportation and healthcare, really, really cool things to help software in the world.
Elad.
For me, it would be mass scale sequencing of the human population. So I think ultimately...
Gene sequencing.
Yeah, so I think we're moving to an era where gene sequencing is extremely cheap and it's going to get even cheaper. And so it's going to fundamentally shift multiple aspects of our healthcare system. So I think that's coming pretty soon.
Well, let's give a big round of applause to Dave McClure, Christina Broadbeck, Naval Ravikant, Bill Clerico, and Elad Gill for sharing their tips tonight and this guide to getting angel investing. So now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.